I thought quite a bit about the topic for today's split sermon. There have been just a few notable events happening lately, after all. We actually had one announcement this morning in Youngstown about a couple who yesterday celebrated their 67th anniversary in the Youngstown congregation, Don and Faye Lambert. So we're trying to catch them, but I don't know if we'll ever make it. So getting closer. Some of those events that have been happening have been on the world scene, frequently not very pleasant ones in that area. Some have been national developments, similar comment. Some are more locally based, and that one's often kind of a mixed bag. Hopefully we do see occasional heartwarming stories from time to time, and that's pleasant when we do. Some have had to do with the church and its work. I would say, and that's a very much more encouraging thing. Think the ministerial conference. The last couple of In Accords have made reference to it. Mr. Horchak spoke about it a little bit in this week's In Accord as well, and talked about Pentecost weekend. Also, the last locale is this weekend for the International Leadership Program, the third round. There are 8 sessions, and this session is in Guatemala. It started, started today, really, although yesterday, last evening, the leaders have been gathering. The administration flew down, and the various couples who are attending would have been gathering last night to begin their 3 or 4 day period of time of the International Leadership Training Program. Summer camps are starting tomorrow with the preteen camp in Texas, Lone Star. And things move along. It just always seems to happen that way. Some events, of course, for all of us, are personal events. As you know, for Janelle and me, we've passed recently, just last week, a week ago today actually was the actual date, a rather significant milestone in our lives, the 50th anniversary of our wedding. We do plan to have a small wedding picture album out tomorrow, so you can make amused comments yourself when you who are those people in that picture. We may have to supply some evidence of the fact that the Henrys were not very far behind us, and we have pictures going back that far for them. So you never know, although that's probably something we should save for another occasion. Speaking of 50 years of marriage, I thought long and hard that maybe that would call for a short message on marriage. But then I asked the question, how do you give a short message on marriage after experiencing it for 50 years? And I concluded it probably wasn't the smartest thing to do. So I thought of a little different wrinkle for today's second message. Since our recent extended trip to Texas began with teaching the last 2 weeks of the academic year's class on modern church history, some connected thoughts came to mind. I'd like to follow up on that and move to some lessons that are common to us all, and I think in that theme you'll sense that there was a thread in the two messages today, even though Rich and I really hadn't discussed what we were speaking about with each other ahead of time. We both assured each other there would be no heresy involved, and so that was as far as we went. That was funny. You can laugh. Okay, it wasn't funny. Laugh anyway. No. This year's class at Foundation Institute was unique. It was the third year that I've taught the class, always with my wife's essential help, and I mean that entirely. That help has been in research, in graphic assistance, especially with the PowerPoint support that I need, interaction with the students in ways that she is far more capable than I am, and others that are way too numerous to mention. And I don't think it was any more evident than this past academic year, which just ended not so long ago. This year, our third to work with the program was different from the first two. It was recorded, and we've now have half of those classes posted online. The first 9 from the first semester that we used are up online, of course, and have been there for some time. There are some unique aspects of the online version of the class compared to the classroom version and the experience. But I won't take time to elaborate at length except to observe the most common one is that the most basic difference is that any interactive classroom discussion, which we have in each class, at the end of each class for about 15 to 20 minutes, just can't be communicated in the online version. The classes, each class is 80 minutes in length, and if you've looked at or timed or wondered when it was ever going to be over when you were listening to one of the classes online, they go about 50 to 55 minutes tops. We have 80 minutes in the class. But there is a difference. Something else, though, has become clear to me, especially with the posting of the first semester of the class. The second will follow after the feast. There will be 8 more classes posted online, we believe, beginning October the 18th through the last one then on Wednesday, December the 6th. Ironically, that'll be the same day that we begin teaching again, starting all over again for the 4th year. But I realized after reading some of the responses that I've received, both written in the form of questions, just emails, there have been several emails that have been sent, kind comments made personally, I'm addressing 2 distinctly different groups. 2 completely different groups. There is the classroom presence, the classes that are actually there, a total of 20 in the class. There will be 17 of those online for various reasons. This year's class was the smallest that FI has had in its 11 academic years with only 8 students. There have been 175 graduates to the program, so you can do the math and figure out what the average is. This year's class ranged in age from 19 to 30. Only one was over the age of 25, the 30-year-old, obviously. But from the responses that have been sent in to me or that I've received or some of the back-and-forth email strings that I've engaged in with a few who want to talk about it some more, and I'm happy to do that, it's clear that the online audience is significantly older, quite a bit older. In fact, several of the comments have started to come in the last 2 or 3 that were posted as we get into events in the 60s and even pushing ahead a little bit and making a few references to the 1970s here and there. Some people have started to say, well, now you're getting to the time period I remember. So again, clearly, a much older audience, a much older average. Those 2 groups, these 2 groups, have a very different time-located outlook on life. Each one of us occupies a certain space of time in historical spectrum or timeline. And our experiences, our reactions, our perceptions, our decisions, our view of life, the world around us, and to some degree even God's plan, all vary with our placement on that timeline. That's just the way history works. What does that mean for us? For those of us who are the called out ones, what does that mean? One of the things it means is that our recall of events that happen in our world, our recall of events is very different along a generational timeline. It's like those 2 sets of FI students, let's say. The much older group that is the average listening online. There are some young ones, of course, too. But then the classroom presence, of whom all but one ranged in a tight 6-year age range from 19 to 25 this past year. It's quite a different look, quite a different spacing on the historical spectrum. For example, let me give you some dates and see how your perceptions resonate with those dates. If I say the year 1975, what does that mean to you? Well, in church speak, you might think, if you've been in the church for a long time, maybe several decades, you might say, well, yeah, I remember when, back when we thought we sort of had things figured out time-wise and the whole 2 19 years time cycles deal, like the early church from AD 31, you know, to AD 69, maybe it would happen in this time period too, the same beginning of the World Tomorrow broadcast, the Plain Truth magazine, really the work of the church in this era, 1934, add 38 years, 1972, 3.5 years for the Great Tribulation, you know the drill, at least some of us did. That maybe Christ would return in the year 1975. Well, that even leaves out a few who are here today, including some of those who are acknowledging getting older, because my son was born in January of 1976. How does that impact you if I say 1975? Historically, the final pullout of the U.S. military from the war in Southeast Asia in Vietnam happened in 1975. The news footage of helicopters airlifting American soldiers from the roof of the American embassy in what was then called Saigon, South Vietnam. No such city exists now. There's a city there, but it's not Saigon, South Vietnam. It's just Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. That's what has changed. That was 1975, the fall of Saigon, now Ho Chi Minh City. Online students that are listening to the class now would probably have to be in their mid-50s to really remember and have some kind of a connection to what was going on then. A U.S. news magazine some time ago used to publish pretty frequently an analysis of history and what percentage of the population could remember things. And they gave, as a kind of a rule of thumb, their suggestion was a child would have to be around the age of 10 to have some recognition of what was going on in the wider world around him or around her and know where it would fit. The thinking being that much younger than that, they really wouldn't understand or appreciate it. For example, stepping back out of sequence a bit here, but back a little over 20 years ago to the events of 9-1-1, 2001, we'll get there in a moment, but there were reports of very young children being quite traumatized at seeing the constant footage of the Twin Towers collapsing. Because in their very young ability to assimilate it, maybe 5 or 6 or 7 years old, they couldn't always grasp the fact that this was the same event that was just being shown over and over again. To them, it was happening again, and it traumatized them because they weren't old enough to have that connection yet. In a similar way, several years back, I was watching television with one of our kids. I will protect the name of the innocent. We were watching a golf tournament together, and it wasn't my son. So it was our older daughter. Anyway, she was younger then. We were watching this golf tournament together, and because I was quite interested in it and getting excited about it, she decided she would watch with me. She was quite young, maybe 4 or 5. And one of the golfers on this tournament had a hole. He shot a hole in one, par 3. It was a hole in one in the cup. And I got pretty excited about it. So she did too. And then they showed a videotape replay of it, and she punched me. She said, "Daddy, look, he did it again." Because at 4 years old, you can't process that. Rare. So when you talk about perceptions, you have to be, this one magazine said, 10 years old, thereabouts. So unless you're at least in your mid-50s, you probably don't have much recall of the events of 1975 with much of an analysis of what it meant. What if I say 1986? What does that mean to you? Well, in terms of church experiences, those certainly who were alive at the time and recall it would remember that on January the 16th of 1986, Herbert W. Armstrong died. And that was a big thing in the church. He was the only leader the church had ever known in that era of time. And there were honest questions that came forward. And again, we cover some of that in the class, of course. But unless you're at least 45 or very, very close to it, you would probably have a little trouble assimilating what it meant and how it impacted your life. You'd have to be at least in your mid-40s, most likely. Just 12 days later, on January the 28th, the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded on takeoff, January 28th, 1986. It was carrying Christa McAuliffe, and there was a big deal made about she was the first teacher to be sent into space. Thousands of school children were watching the launch across the world, across the country, across the world. And I can only imagine the horror in her classroom in New England, watching the shuttle explode. But again, that was 1986. Unless you're awfully close to your mid-40s, that doesn't have any immediate visceral connection. You don't know. It's just history. What about 1991? You might say, well, that's reaching a bit. That was the first Gulf War. First Gulf War. Send troops in to defend Kuwait back at that time. The president was George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, later called in history. Online class, well, those online watching have to be probably into their 40s, early 40s, to really have much recall of that because it happened so long ago, 32 years ago. Class, the FI class, so far, none of these categories have any of this year's FI students been born yet, the things I've discussed. Nobody was born by 1975. Nobody was born by 1986. Nobody was born by 1991 in this year's FI class. You see the difference in the audience. 1995, what does that mean to you? Well, church development, we would say, most of us would view that as the collapse of the worldwide Church of God as we knew it. Online class, if you're in your mid-30s, if the online viewers are in their mid-30s, they might recall it. It was 28 years ago, so perhaps if they're mid-30s or so, 35, 36, and perhaps a bit younger, you would realize that some things changed, but you would have only the memories of a child in regard to it. This year is FI online class. The oldest student from this year was 2 years old in 1995. Obviously no recollection, no ability to process what it was. 911, what does that mean to you? September 11th, 2001. That was what is a coming of age event for a specific generation. Every generation in time has a sort of coming of age event that bonds an entire generation together in a common memory. For my generation, our generation, the boomers, it was November the 22nd, 1963, the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I know exactly where I was, what I was doing, who I talked to, what transpired. I was not quite 12 years of age. 911 was that event for a generation. Those who were born, perhaps, in the early 90s. The terrorist attack on the United States, on this soil. The online students, well, if they're at least 30 years of age, they probably remembered it was 22, not quite 22 years ago. And they have some recollection of what it meant. The FI class, some of the youngest of this year's FI class were not yet born on September the 11th, 2001. 2011, what does that mean to you? The Church of God, a worldwide association, was incorporated within the last 2 weeks of December 2010, and the church officially formed a pattern of organization at a conference in January of 2011 in Louisville, Kentucky at the Galt House. The online class, almost all of that group will recall it very clearly and say, I remember that very well, January 2011, even though it's more than 12 years ago. But as long as they're at least in their 20s or even late teenage, they probably remember it. This year's class at FI, you know how old they were in January of 2011? From 4 to 14. From 4 to 14. I see a few out there, a few individuals just shaking heads in disbelief. Most of those individuals have hair very much the same color as mine. time does that to all human beings. You can probably begin to see what the impetus was in adding the class that I've been asked to teach to the curriculum at Foundation Institute. The thinking was that learning about our heritage, our legacy, who we are as a body of believers, and where we came from is important for each generation to understand. And it's important especially for the generation growing to adulthood in the church right now. Those who, when even this body of believers was officially formed, were between the ages of 4 and 14. The youngest of those does not even remember the formation of CAGWA, not with any recognition. The memories, again, would be those of a child. How can that tie all of us together, brethren? That's what I want to talk about. Because there's something ingenious that God uses to impart that understanding to all of us, to all of his children from all ages. Let's try to list, for example, a few high spots of what we know God is doing here below. Let me just list a few things for you. Creation, give or take 6,000 years, and maybe I should say the recreation, the reforming of the surface of the earth. We don't believe that the earth itself is only 6,000 years old or that the universe is only 6,000 years old. Some groups do believe that. They have to explain the fact that the earth quite apparently has signs that are visibly much, much, much older than that. And so they have a doctrine, what they call the theory or the doctrine of apparent age. But think about what that means. That means that God has to engage in some sort of subterfuge to present something that's really only 6,000 years old as if it's possibly hundreds of thousands or even, who knows, millions. We don't know. Would God do that? Is that typical of his mind to take that approach? I don't think it is. Creation. Okay, let's move along this scale. The move to working with a nation of people, ancient Israel, not just the patriarchs like Noah or Enoch or Abraham or Isaac, Jacob, and so on. That step. All right, another step. Christ's first coming to walk the earth as a human being for 33 and a half years. Those of us who were just blessed and privileged to take trips to Israel, to take those tours, FI continuing education tours, it's astonishing what broader perspective it gives you to know where you are and who was there. And, of course, his sacrificial death to pay for our sins. His resurrection, his ascension to resume his place beside the Father in the third heaven. Then there's the founding of the New Testament church, very, very close in time to that event. Nearly 2,000 years ago now, you realize in 8 years we could be talking on the Feast of Pentecost and we could say, today is the 2,000th anniversary of the birth of the New Testament church. In just 8 years we could be saying that. Then we could say, well, the carrying out of God's work here below by a body of believers. Matthew 24:14, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. We might say, well, I sort of relate to a part of that. Isn't that what we're all about doing right now? Well, it is. We'll come back to that in a moment. The return of Jesus Christ. We've jumped way ahead now to a time period we don't even have a date for because it hasn't happened yet. It most certainly did not happen on or around the Feast of Trumpets in 1975, as some speculated very strongly that it might. The resurrection of the saints, the first resurrection, what the Bible calls in Revelation 20, the first resurrection. How about the banishment of Satan? That'll be a big step. That'll be a huge step. Try to comprehend that. The establishment and then the spread of the reach of the ruling family or kingdom of God, with that first family's first job to be the millennial reign of Jesus Christ for 1,000 years. Then how about the second resurrection? When those who have not yet had their chance in God's judgment, in His perfect assessment, will be given the chance to understand and become part of His family. And then there's the destruction of the incorrigibly wicked, those who have known in the sense that they had the opportunity to choose the right path and chose poorly, what we sometimes call the third resurrection. And then one final step, the arrival of God the Father on this earth. What the Bible then refers to as a new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, and a new heavens and a new earth, a new order of things completely. And obviously, if the Father is here on this planet and His Son Jesus Christ is with Him, and they're changed into spirit children are with them in the family, this will become the headquarters of the entire universe. Now let me ask you a question. That's a pretty good list to work with. It's a pretty long timeline. So let's go to work. Which of those events do you remember? You might say, well, what do you mean? Trick question. What do you mean, none of them? Well, you might say, well, one of them partially, that bit about Matthew 24 and the gospel of the kingdom being preached, that like I feel like I'm a partial, tiny little part of that on the spectrum of human experience, and you'd be right. That's what we all share in doing. You might say, well, the business of creation, every weekly Sabbath we sort of think as a memorial of the original creation, a reminder of the fact that that's when the Sabbath was created and came into being. Okay, that's fair too. The rest, well, some of them happened long ago, and another huge chunk are yet in the future. But lessons about people and their lives are such important ways to learn. Look at Christ's own teaching. What was one of the methods He used most often? He used practical examples of people's lives. We call them parables. He used stories about people. That's how we relate. Look at that list again that I went through. How many of them involve something that you and I acknowledge every year in our lives? How many of them? Well, I suppose you could say, in one sense, seven. Seven specifically. Seven festivals of God. In effect, we become part of the central cast of the most important parable in God's Word. In that light, many years ago, my wife and I were in New Zealand for the Feast of Tabernacles, for a portion of the feast that year, and one of the elders serving there, Mr. Art Verschuer, mentioned in a sermon a phrase that has stuck with me. He said, in talking about the conditions that the millennial reign of Christ will bring to this earth, how things will be so different and changed, he made the statement, we must be living parables of the kingdom. We must be living parables of the kingdom. Why is that? Well, because, brethren, we're going to be its administrators. Look at Revelation chapter 5. Revelation chapter 5. We'll look at verse 10. We find the angels singing in verse 9. So they're not singing about themselves. They're singing about a part of God's plan. And so in verse 10 it says, "You have made them," would be a better translation, as some commentators put in the margin. "You have made them kings and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth." Revelation chapter 20. Revelation chapter 20 is, somewhat surprisingly, the first place in the entire Bible we find how long the millennial reign of Christ will be. In fact, we're able to call it the millennial reign because of these verses here. Revelation 20 mentions several times that it's 1,000 years in length, and it's the first place it occurs in the third last chapter of the entire Bible. And in verse 4, it says, "I saw thrones," John's vision he's recording, "and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Then there's a parenthetical thought at the beginning of verse 5. "But the rest of the dead didn't live again until those 1,000 years were finished." And then it returns to the description in the last few words of verse 5. This is the first resurrection, what he talked about in verse 4. And he goes on to explain a little more. "Blessed and holy," excuse me, "is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. We will be the administrators of the kingdom. What does that mean to you? How well are you learning to understand it? Take a parable. Let's go back, for starters, to Matthew 13. You probably know that there are some chunks of the Gospels where you can encounter parable after parable after parable. Matthew 13 is one of them. Look at the first 9 verses. Familiar parable of the sower. "On the same day Jesus went out of the house," verse 1, "sat by the sea. Great multitudes were gathered together to him, so he got into a boat and sat, and the whole multitude stood on the shore." Natural amplification of sound. "And then he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, 'Behold, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seed fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured those. Some fell on stony places where they didn't have much earth, and they immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. Some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked them. But others fell on good ground and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Where do you fit in that parable? If we're to be a living parable of the kingdom, where do you fit? It's important that we know. The next several verses, Jesus explains the purpose of parables. And then he tells them something in verse 16. "Blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For assuredly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and hear what you hear and did not hear it." Has it occurred to you that because of their time placement in the carrying out of God's plan, there are some of the names that we read in the pages of God's Word who, when they're resurrected, will want to talk to you and to me and hear us explain how we could understand certain things hundreds of years after their lives? Because on that time placement line, they were way back here. And you and I are here, and we can understand more. That's the way history always works. But there are some things we're going to find that are amazingly in common. The next few verses, verses 18 to 23, Jesus explains the meaning of the parable of the sower. He talks about the wheat and the tares in verses 24 to 30, a scary parable because it seems that that will always be with us until Christ's return. And then there are the parables of tiny things in verses 31 and 32 and 33. Look at verses 34 and 35, the application that really matters. All these things Jesus spoke to the multitude in parables. And without a parable, he did not speak to them, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken, I will open my mouth in parables, I will utter things kept secret from the foundation of the world. How does God reveal those things? How do we come to understand lessons we have to know? Why do we understand things the world around us cannot? Well, brethren, one of the things that I will insist upon nagging you and any congregation I'm around for as long as I can is about the importance of the annual festivals. Without them, we lose a framework. They help us to be those living parables. The quote in Matthew is from Psalm 78. It's interesting. He says that it might be fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet, but the quote is from Psalm 78. The prophet was the author of the 78th Psalm. It says, a contemplation of Asaph in the time of David. And it's basically a history of ancient Israel. He says, give ear, my people, to my law. Incline your ears, verse 1, to the words of my mouth. I'll open my mouth in a parable. I'll utter dark sayings of old, which we've heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord, his strength, his wonderful works he's done, for he has established a testimony in Jacob, appointed a law in Israel which he commanded our fathers they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they might arise and declare them to their children, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that didn't set its heart aright, whose spirit wasn't faithful. Are we busily being about our Father's business in this way? Do we know where we fit in that parable? Do we know where our placement is on the timeline of God's plan? You look through this chapter, it's an interesting story. The next few verses talk about their problem in ancient Israel and how they turned back. They didn't keep God's covenant. They saw all these things. And then it says in verse 17, they sinned even more against him by rebelling against the Most High in the wilderness. They tested God in their heart by asking for the food of their fancy. They couldn't get the big picture. When you come down to verse 37 of Psalm 78, it summarizes their heart was not steadfast with him, nor were they faithful in his covenant. But he, being full of compassion, forgave their iniquity, did not destroy them. Many a time he turned his anger away and didn't stir up all his wrath. He remembered they were but flesh, a breath that passes away and doesn't come again. Our spot on that timeline is pretty small when you get right down to it. Pretty small. My wife discovered a song the other day that talks about time and how fast it goes, and it talks about, there's one line in it that they sing, how many minutes there are in a year and how fast it goes. 525,600 minutes in a year. Of course, if it's a leap year, you have to modify that, but that's picky. But how fast does it go by? How fast does 525,600 minutes go by? And if you repeat that enough times, eventually the minutes run out. That's the way life works. We're on the timeline. Where do we fit? Verse 40 says, how often they provoked him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. Yes, again and again they tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his power the day when he redeemed them from the enemy. Brethren, do we constantly remember how God has redeemed us from the enemy, from Satan, from our own sin? In the annual observance of his times, partly, we think of Passover, the days of unleavened bread. We even think a little bit in the fall on the Day of Atonement, the time when Satan will be bound, the ceremony of the two goats. And we think about how he helps us blunt the fiery darts of the wicked one that are referred to by Paul in Ephesians 6. But right here in Psalm 78, verse 52, he made his own people go forth like sheep. He guided them in the wilderness like a flock. He led them on safely so they did not fear, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies. He brought them to his holy border, this mountain which his right hand had acquired. He drove out the nations before them, allotted them an inheritance by survey, made the tribes of Israel dwell in their tents. And it goes on to talk about how they tested and provoked him. But look where he wants to go in verse 70. He also chose David his servant, took him from the sheepfolds, from following the ewes that had young, he brought him to shepherd Jacob his people and Israel his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. David, of course, will have a role to play in the future in God's family. We know this from other prophecies. And brethren, he teaches us every year. We are now between feast seasons. We're always between feast seasons one way or the other, aren't we? But we're between seasons 2 and 3 in the annual pattern. Seasons 1 and 2, for the most part, deal with issues and events and occurrences and history of what went before. There's a part of Pentecost that is a self-identifying part. It tells us who we are, the first fruits in God's plan. That's true. But for the most part, we are between the seasons that talk about the past and the third season that talks about the future, because all of the four festivals in the fall are yet future. They haven't yet happened, and yet you and I are asked to trust that they will. My son referred to some of that in his first message today. What it means to have faith in God. You and I are still those living parables of God's kingdom, which proves something very interesting. Do you remember all those statistics I gave about who does and who does not remember certain events? And I picked on our poor FI class this year because I kept saying, they weren't born yet, they weren't born yet, they weren't born yet. Oh, the oldest one was 2, you know. Why is that? Because as time passes, new babies are born. I have on occasion had someone come up to me and remind me, as I'm speaking to their strapping 16-year-old who towers over me and could probably bounce me into the next county in about like that, and remind me, do you remember when you picked him up and blessed him in the blessing of children? I'm going, I'm glad he wasn't 16. Time passes. Time passes. New babies are born. They have no direct recollection of events before their birth, or even ones from their earliest years of life. They don't grasp the significance yet, the directness, the connection to what's happening around them. They're too young. And as they say, history repeats itself. So do you see what God does? In his plan, he takes some events that have already happened, which none of us remember, and he takes several more that are yet in the future, which none of us have seen. And he constructs a set of annual observances, special times, festivals, holy days. And he guides us, all of us, to keep and observe them every year. You know, you could ask anyone in this room, describe to me the first Feast of Tabernacles you ever remember. Now, you probably couldn't say the first one you ever kept, because some of them might tell you, as Mr. John Pinelli did many years ago in Victoria. He said, well, the first one I ever kept was in utero. I wasn't born yet, so I can't tell you much about it. His mother was giving him a dirty look when he said that, I'm sure. So he can't describe his first feast, or even the first one after he'd been born, because he was born in the church. And now he's past the age of 60. But you can ask anyone in this room, tell me about the first memories you have of the Feast of Tabernacles. And everyone in this room, no matter the age, who has ever kept a Feast of Tabernacles, could give you some memories. In my case, I remember we loaded the covered wagon and we hitched up the oxen. No, we did not. We loaded up the 1959 Studebaker station wagon and we took off for Texas. And I remember the feast. I remember camping in a tent. I remember doing some strange things. My brother and I had a very small little chest of drawers. They emptied the whole thing out, laid it out in the back of that Studebaker, and we took it and put it in the tent, so we had a dresser of drawers in the tent where we were keeping the feast. Kind of strange. I remember my dad digging a trench around the tent so that if it rained, the rain would not run under the tent and get the floor wet. It would stay outside in the trench. I remember cooking our meals, my mom, on our Coleman camp stove. First feast. They've changed a little since then. This year, they ask us to go to Hawaii. Kind of different. You have a memory of the feast. It doesn't matter how long ago it was. It doesn't matter if you say, well, I'm only 10 years old. My first feast that I remember was probably 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and here's what we did. And you might have a memory of an activity you did, a zoo you went to, a llama that, tried to nibble food out of your hand. You would have memories of your first memorable feast. God designed it that way. Talk to some of the others who loaded up the covered wagon, or some approximation. It's beautiful. It's perfect. The memories are different because we're at different time locations. But the pattern will continue. As new ones are born, or are called to his truth in adulthood, they're taught. And they're part of the events of the plan. By living the picture of the plan, either their remembrances or their foretaste every single year. And the lessons are driven home ever more deeply. And we prepare for the future in his family. It's perfect. No one forgets. We do it every year. We become part of the living parable. How could we ever forget? There's one way. One way, if we were ever to stop keeping these feasts. Let's not ever do that. Remember the high points of God's plan, even if we have not yet lived them. Brethren, let's all be collectively a living parable of God's kingdom.